What are you feeling right now? Did the weather forecast make you a little grumpy because you wanted to spend a bunch of time outside today? Is an umbrella enough? Maybe there's something else on your mind. There certainly will be as this hour unfolds and we get to explore a relatively new theory about our emotions and where they come from. They are much more dependent on culture than scientists have thought, so says Lisa Feldman Barrett in her book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Dr. Barrett is a professor of psychology at Northeastern University in Boston, where the snow is, with appointments in psychology and radiology at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. She received a Director's Pioneer Award from the National Institutes of Health for her research into emotion in the brain. Lisa Feldman Barrett, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jeff. Thanks for having me on the show.
Any trouble getting to your office today with the snow?
Just a little bit, yeah.
Okay. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate that. Now, we just talked about the NIH Director's Pioneer Award, and I understand it's meant for high-risk, high-reward research. What was the risk in what you've done here?
Well, the research that I've been doing really for the past 20 years goes against the traditional view of emotion, the idea that emotions are built in, wired into the brain at birth, and that when an emotion circuit is triggered, it produces a stereotyped, very clear expression on the face and a whole pattern in the body that can be recognized by anybody around the world. Our research in my lab, along with a growing number of other scientists, really suggests something very different, that emotions are made on the spot as needed by your brain. And we approach this from a number of different perspectives, but it's high risk in the sense that it contradicts and challenges a deeply held belief that has guided scientific research for a number of decades now.
So what was the beginning of challenging this classical view of emotion? What got you to think, you know, maybe those people back for thousands of years were not right?
Well, when I was in graduate school, I was doing research not on emotion, but I needed to use emotion in order to measure, as a measurement in my experiment. So I needed to measure people's feelings of depression and anxiety. And I noticed that people were not really, that the measures weren't performing the way that they were supposed to. And so in my very naive way, I thought, well, I'll just measure emotion objectively because everybody knows you can do that. You can measure it on the face, you can measure it in the body, and so on. And then I'll get back to doing the research that I had planned to do. I actually failed to replicate 8 studies in a row. So for me, this was a really big deal. When I was in graduate school, I thought, you know, maybe I'm not really cut out to be a scientist. I better find a better way of doing these things. And this introduced me to what I learned and introduced me to the literature on emotion, that in fact there are no objective measures of emotion in the face or in the body or even in the brain. And I started to wonder, how could this possibly be? How could it be that you and I can experience anger, can see sadness in others, can feel the thrill of excitement and joy, and yet scientists have no objective way of measuring any of these things? To me, it seemed like a real puzzle, and it completely changed my whole research trajectory.
So, wow, you're actually going to throw out Paul Ekman's facial action coding system, too?
Well, the facial action coding system, I should say, it, first of all, was not invented by Paul. It was actually invented by a Swedish anatomist. And Paul adapted it in a very, very important way. And the measurement procedure of measuring facial movements as actions is extraordinarily useful. It doesn't necessarily have to be tied to a particular theory. The classical theory, of which Paul's is one, suggests that, you know, when you're afraid, you make a startled-looking facial expression that everyone around the world makes and everyone around the world can recognize. And although there is some evidence to support this idea, there's much more evidence that calls it into doubt. A lot of evidence, not only in the scientific literature, but, for example, the TSA-based security training procedure called SPOT, on the assumption that facial expressions were universally made and recognized. And after spending $900 million, the government realized that the method doesn't work, actually. So I think that that there's, as happens in science, as science progresses, we learn that some things we believed turn out to be false and other things are preserved and are still useful.
I've always been fascinated by Ekman's work, though. And how do you account, for example, for his accuracy in telling things from faces and cultures that he's not familiar with?
Well, That's a really interesting question, Jeff. So my lab has actually gone to northwestern Namibia to examine emotion perception in the Himba tribe. They're very remote and rural, and they have very little access to Western cultural practices and norms. We've also studied the Hadza of Tanzania. They are hunter-gatherers and have continuously hunted and gathered since the Pleistocene era. And in both of these cultures, what we find is that when you use an experimental method that teaches the test subjects American concepts for emotion, the subjects can recognize scowling as anger and smiling as happiness and pouting as sadness. But if you use a slightly different method where you don't teach the method doesn't really implicitly teach subjects the Western concepts for emotion, those test subjects in those cultures don't perceive emotion in faces the way that we do. They don't see scowling faces as angry. They don't see pouting faces as sad, and so on.
So I want to come back, too, to something else you said earlier about how we create emotions. They're made as needed. I mean, obviously, fear does us some good. We get out of the way of what's about to eat us, that sort of thing. But are there biological, physiological needs for other emotions?
Well, the way that the brain works, it seems to us as if the brain is reacting to things in the world. And so, you know, you see a snake and you jump out of the way. Someone insults you, and so you feel the urge to punch them. But your brain actually doesn't really work like that. Your brain is anticipating, it's guessing what is going to happen next. And those guesses prepare your body to act and become the basis of your emotion. And this all happens in the blink of an eye and entirely outside your awareness. So what your brain needs to do is make sense of the sensory inputs from your body and the world. That's what it's attempting to do.
All right. Much more to talk about with Lisa Feldman Barrett. Her book is How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And we're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lisa Feldman Barrett, professor of psychology at Northeastern University in Boston. She is the author of a book that really upends thousands of years of human belief about where emotions come from. Her book is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It doesn't surprise me we get to talk about babies in here because this is, you know, when we learn emotions. But that is the question. I mean, babies smile when they appear to be happy. They give us the downturned mouth when they're sad. Are those learned, or is there some kind of brain structure that gives a push toward those?
Well, I think it's important to understand that an infant brain does not look like a miniature adult brain. The infant brain is born. When an infant is born, the brain is doesn't have much of the fully formed wiring that we see in an adult brain. So an infant brain is a brain that's awaiting a set of wiring instructions for how to wire itself to the surrounding environment that it's in. So babies are not born with circuits for anger and sadness and fear and so on. It's not the case that when babies certainly are born with the circuitry for pleasure, for pain, to feel discomfort, to feel pleasant, to feel worked up, to feel calm. But when a baby cries, for example, there's nothing encoded in the sound of their cry in the acoustics that tells a parent whether they're tired, cranky, hungry, cold. This is something that a parent has to guess at. A parent is making sense of those cries using the context and their knowledge of the baby. So the question really for us becomes, when do babies learn to smile in happiness and to pout in sadness, to scowl in anger? And by what means does the brain learn to do this? And there's some evidence from other research on infants to suggest that emotion words in general, are important for shaping the wiring of a little human brain and probably help children to understand the kinds of emotion concepts they need in order to experience emotion.
All right, so we learn happy, we learn sad, we learn angry.
Yeah, so your your brain, my brain, every human brain on the planet is wired in a way to control your body. And the sensory consequences of the movements in your body, changes in heart rate, changes in respiration, changes in your immune system, your metabolism, and so on, you and I feel those, and so do infants, as pleasure and pain, as discomfort and enjoyment, as feeling worked up and agitated and feeling calm. And those are one set of basic ingredients that are used to create, to make the emotions that we in Western cultures experience every day, happiness, sadness, anger, and so on.
All right. We obviously spent a lot of time talking about the face in here, but I had to laugh about the part of the book where you talk about delivering this research to other groups of researchers. You could see the faces they were making back at you. You got some of them angry, it sounds like.
I sure did. And, you know, this was, I wish, you know, in some ways that I had been videotaping them, because the kinds of faces that they made, trust me, they weren't all scowling faces. And sometimes, you know, people would get pretty upset. It's hard for scientists. It's hard for us, I think, when we, you know, we invest so much of our time and energy and our careers, really, in a particular theory that might turn out to be wrong.
Well, and you are definitely challenging things here. Let's talk about population thinking and how it changed your approach to what you're doing here.
Sure. I think the assumption that people do one thing when they're sad, one thing when they're angry, and so on, is just blatantly false, I think. People, for example, think about yourself when you're afraid. You can tremble in fear, you can jump in fear, you can freeze in fear, you can scream in fear, you can attack in fear, you can even laugh in the face of fear. You do many different things when you're afraid. What you do, in part, depends on your prior experience that your brain has encoded, has for use in making future instances of fear. So variety is the norm. And what's really interesting is the idea that fear as a category, as a group of instances, is a population of highly variable instances that your brain is able to make in a way that matches whatever situation you happen to be in is very consistent with an idea called population thinking, which Charles Darwin introduced in On the Origin of Species. So Charles Darwin before Darwin, a species was, the idea of a species was that there was a single animal who was a perfect form, you know, let's say like a perfect Cocker Spaniel, who had all the perfect features of a Cocker Spaniel, and any variation around that perfection, say longer ears or a shorter nose or a stubbier tail, was considered to be error. And Darwin demonstrated very nicely that the variability is very important in helping a species to survive in many different environments. And so similarly, many categories that we think of as being biological categories don't have necessary and sufficient features. They don't have a fingerprint. There's tremendous variability, and nature really encourages this variability. Natural selection selects for systems that have tremendous variation.
Lisa Feldman Barrett is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. So, Lisa, are there parts of the brain that normally feel one emotion or the other, or is it pretty well distributed around the brain?
Your brain is making emotion as a whole brain experience. So think of your brain as having a set of ingredients, kind of all-purpose ingredients. So in the same way that you have in your kitchen, you know, flour and salt and water, and you can make many, many different food substances with those ingredients, and sometimes even things that aren't food, like glue, for example. In the same way, your brain has a set of networks and circuits that are more multi-purpose, or what scientists call domain general. And these are like basic ingredients that combine together to make the variety of emotions that you feel, but also they make your thoughts, your memories, your perceptions. They guide action and so on.
Okay, all kinds of things that go on in there. I want to get into the concept of simulation and how much we perceive versus how much we sort of categorize based on things we've seen before. There's a great story in here about your daughter's 12th birthday party as we get back to the kitchen here.
Yeah, right. So So in my daughter's birthday party, that's actually a great example of how simulation works. We threw my daughter a 12th birthday party where we focused on gross food. So we were trying to throw a disgust party, essentially. And so what we did was serve pizza that I had doctored with green food coloring so that the cheese kind of looked like fuzzy mold. And I made vomit jello with, it was really
vomit
gross.
Looking jello, we should explain.
I used peach gelatin and I laced it with bits of vegetables to look like vomit. And I served apple juice and white grape juice in medicine and medical urine sample cups. The kids, you know, were able to simulate in their mind's eye the vile tastes and smells kind of involuntarily. So, for example, if I said to you right now, you know, in your mind's eye, keep your eyes open, can you imagine a red, shiny Macintosh apple? Can you see the ghost of a red, shiny Macintosh apple in your mind's eye? Most people can. And most people can also hear the crunch in their mind's eye, or in their mind's ear, I guess, when they imagine biting into the apple. And they can conjure a little bit of the taste, that sort of sweet, tart taste of the apple. And so what your brain is doing in these instances right now, actually, as I'm talking about this, is some parts of the brain are causing the other parts in your brain, in the visual, in parts that are responsible for vision, responsible for audition, responsible for taste, it's causing those neurons to change their firing. So without any visual input at all, without any taste input at all, your brain can change the firing of its own neurons and give you a simulation or sort of a pre-experience of what is outside in the world. And in the ultimate simulation game that we used at my daughter's birthday party was we took mashed up baby food, so mashed up beef and mashed up spinach and so on, and we artfully smeared it onto diapers to look exactly like baby poo. And then the guests, the kids, had to take a diaper and hold it up to their nose and take a really good deep whiff of the diaper in order to identify the food by its smell. And several of them actually gagged, real full body gag at the simulated smell, because of course they were simulating the smell of poo.
So obviously what you were doing there, where you were challenging assumptions that go on in the brain, consciously or unconsciously. I met a neuroscientist a couple of years ago who said that up to 90% of what we generally experience, though, comes from inside because it meets our assumptions. Is that a fair figure?
Yeah, I think it is. If you look at the wiring of the brain, it's very, very clear that you are not reacting to the world. Your brain is proactive. It's making guesses about what's going to happen next using simulation. So before you go to pick up an apple, the motor neurons in your brain start to fire as if you're holding the apple. Your taste neurons start to change their firing in a way that anticipates the taste of an apple and so on. And then these simulations are like your brain's guesses for what is about to happen. And then when you actually pick up the apple and taste it, that input either confirms the simulation, it confirms the prediction, which then becomes your experience, or it modifies the prediction. So, for example, have you ever gone to pick up a glass of clear liquid and assumed it was water, taken a drink, and find that, in fact, it's not water, it's something else, maybe vodka or some other clear liquid, and it's so surprising to you and unpleasant because it was not what you expected? Those expectations are actually simulations.
Well, it's like when you pick up the milk carton, the opaque one, and you think it's really heavy, and it's not, and you practically hit the ceiling with it, yeah.
Exactly, or when you're walking, for example, in the airport, you're on one of those moving walkways, and even though you know the walkway's going to stop, and you know that you have to step off, there's always a bit of a jolt. It's because your brain is predicting what it feels like to be on that moving walkway, and then you feel that jolt because your brain just hasn't predicted very well, and it corrects itself fairly quickly. so that you don't fall over.
We're taking a tour of the brain and emotions and culture, and Lisa Feldman Barrett is our guide here on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of psychology at Northeastern University in Boston. She's the author of the book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And yes, emotions are made, she says, which upends thousands of years of the classical view of emotion. You can join this conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when we think about simulation as relates to emotions, I mean, sometimes our body is giving us cues and we think it's one thing and it's really not. I mean, like, you know, gee, I'm getting sweaty when she approaches. Do I love her or am I having a heart attack?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So when you feel a dull ache in your stomach, you don't know. Your brain is basically using the context to make sense of what that dull ache is. It could be that you're anxious. It could be that you're feeling disgusted. It could be that you're feeling longing for someone. It could be that you are feeling nauseated or hungry.
So if emotion is not as automatic and hardwired into the brain as we think it is, I mean, could in a different culture somebody smile when they are angry or frown when they are happy?
In our culture, people smile when they are angry and they frown when they're happy. I guess what I would say, Jeff, is this. Emotions are pretty automatic because your brain is very, very efficient at using its past experience, what you've learned in your past, to conjure the present. So in much the same way as you look around your office or the room you're in right now, and you probably see computers and a microphone and so on, your brain is making perceptions of those objects for you in exactly the way that it makes emotion. It's doing it in the blink of an eye, very automatically, without your awareness. That being said, if someone presented to you, as I do in the book and also in the talks that I give, I present visual input that you've never seen before, and so your brain can't make sense of it, you are experientially blind. You don't see an object, you just see a bunch of blobs on the screen or on the page. In a similar way, if you haven't experienced certain types of emotion before, you don't have the concepts for them, they're not in your culture, you will have a hard time experiencing them. And in fact, the web is littered with fabulous websites about all of these emotion concepts that don't exist in English. And these are experiences that people have in other cultures that we tend not to have until we learn those concepts and learn how to make those emotions.
Well, and I should point out, this is not just about how we feel emotions in ourselves, but how we perceive them in others. There's a lot of that in this book. And there's a great example in here where you show the face of a woman screaming in terror at the beginning of chapter 3 in the book. Only she's not screaming in terror because it's what, Serena Williams?
Well, I don't want to give it away, so I'm not going to. I'm not going to answer. I'm going to plead the fifth right there, because it is in the book. But yes, it's exactly the case. When we look at people's faces, we are not reading emotions in a face the way that we read words on a page. Emotions, you know, a face doesn't speak for itself when it comes to emotion. So, for example, in my husband works for a particular company that is an international company, and they have an office in Venlo. Americans smile way more than Dutch people smile on average. I have a close friend who grew up in the Netherlands who said that when she moved to the U.S., her face hurt for a year, her cheeks hurt for a year from smiling so much. She'd never smiled so much in her life. And so for a company that's international, it's really challenging, for example, because if you're a manager who has direct reports both in the U.S. and in the Netherlands, the ones from the Netherlands are going to seem much less enthusiastic to you because you're probably misunderstanding their facial expressions, their facial movements. In the U.S., we smile all the time. In other cultures, people smile somewhat less. It doesn't mean that they're less happy. It just means they have different ways of moving their faces and their bodies when they are happy.
And you come to think of it, those do change over time. And I think about this often during sporting contests where somebody does something great. You know, they score a 100-yard touchdown or they hit a 3-pointer at a key moment in a basketball game or something. And the look on their face is not what it was 40 years ago. It's not a look of unalloyed joy. It's a look of like, I have just eaten somebody's spleen.
Exactly. Actually, there are some fantastic experiments that have been done where scientists have looked at at athletes and at Olympic athletes in particular, when they realize that they have medaled, right? They've placed, mm-hmm. they won a silver or gold medal, and what their faces look like when they know that they're being filmed by a camera, or when they know that the audience is looking, versus when they are, you know, are thinking that they're alone. And it tends to be the case that we make these stereotyped expressions, smiling when we're happy and so on, when we know that other people are around. But when we're by ourselves, we do lots of different things with our faces when we're happy. And actually, this is true for every emotion.
All right. Much more to talk about with Lisa Feldman Barrett. The book is How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. We'll come back and talk more with Lisa and take some phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking to Lisa Feldman Barrett about our minds and getting our minds blown in the process. She's a professor of psychology at Northeastern University in Boston, with appointments in psychology and radiology at both Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. Yes, it's slippery in Boston from the snow. But the bigger issue is that Lisa's written a book called How Emotions Are Made, as in they are not entirely dependent upon basic humanity, but largely dependent on culture as well. How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain, the subtitle. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about where emotions come from, both in the brain and elsewhere in the body. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's a great point here as you walk us further into what goes on in the brain here. And obviously the brain doesn't shut down between experiences. It's not just sort of an idle mode, really, ever. What's intrinsic brain activity, Lisa?
You're so right, Jeff. This is actually one of the most important discoveries that scientists have made in the last decade or two. To us, it seems as if we are sitting still and then things happen in the world that impinge upon us. So it seems like our brains are off and then, you know, something is there for us to see and then we see it. But actually, that's really not how things work at all in our brains. Our brains are structured in a way so that their brain activity is constantly occurring all the time. This is what scientists called intrinsic brain activity. It means that even when you're unaware of having a thought or having a very strong feeling, your brain is always working. Neurons are on all the time. The idea that we only use 10% of our brain is a really fun idea for science fiction movies, but it actually doesn't reflect the real science of how brains work. So your brain has intrinsic activity. It's constantly predicting all the time, constantly anticipating what's going to happen next. This is true from the moment that you wake up until the moment that you go to sleep. And even when you're asleep, your brain is still on. It's keeping you asleep while it's regulating your body to keep you alive.
So this is certainly helpful in psychology as well as neuroscience, because if you realize that you're constantly predicting and expecting things, if you change your expectations and predictions, your emotional reactions would be somewhat different then too, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. One of the really important pieces and little gems, I think, in the book is that the understanding a little bit more about how a brain works really empowers you to change your emotional life. Most of us, when we try to control our emotions, we're usually trying to do it in the moment. We're feeling something that we'd rather not feel. We're trying to avoid doing something we'd rather not do. But most of us also know that it's really hard to just snap your fingers and change how you feel. You really can't do it. It's really, really hard. It takes a lot of effort, and most of us find it really challenging. However, if you understand that your brain is constantly guessing what's going to happen next, and that these guesses are the basis of your emotion, and that the guesses are based on your past experience, then it means that you understand that your past is one ingredient in making your emotions in the present. And that means what you experience in the present today will become the seeds for new predictions and new experiences in the future. Those new predictions are made usually with very little effort, very automatically. So if you want to change how you're going to feel tomorrow, one thing you can do is change, is try to cultivate new experiences and learn new emotion words today.
So that would put two general statements on fairly shaky ground. One is that, well, anybody would have reacted that way in this situation. That's one. The other one is, well, that's just how I feel. Both of those, are, it seems like, are on shaky ground based on what you're telling us here today.
Yes and no. I mean, I think the idea that there is, you know, in the law, there's this idea of the reasonable person, you know, that anyone would react in a particular, in this way. If anyone would react in the same way, then you're usually held less, to be less responsible for your actions. But in fact, what we know is that anything like the reasonable person is mainly a stereotype. What people do in a given situation can vary tremendously depending on their past experience, and even what you do in a given situation, if you encounter that situation, the same situation twice, what you do may differ depending on how much sleep you had the night before, whether or not you just had coffee, did you just 15 minutes ago have an argument with someone or not? You know, all of these things count as context to making our present feelings. So I think it's, you know, in some ways we have to, in our culture, we need to have standards for what we think of as typical behavior, but typical behavior is usually highly variable. It's much more variable than we usually give credit for.
I see your point about standards for behavior, because if you acted like you had just scored the winning touchdown in the Super Bowl every time you made a sale at work or something, the office would be a reckless place indeed.
Yeah, people wouldn't like you very much, and you know, you wouldn't have very many friends.
So I was waiting for you to get here, and on page 81 you finally do. Mr. Spock is in there. knowing what we do, can we turn emotions off? And more importantly, should we? I mean, it sounds like emotions are entirely central to who we are as human beings.
I agree completely. I guess what I would say is that in science we have this nice distinction between what we call simple feelings or affect and emotion, which are the full-blown, you know, instances of anger and sadness and fear and so on. Affect, these simple feelings of feeling pleasant or unpleasant, feeling elated or feeling calm, these feelings are the way that we experience the sensory changes in our body. You can't turn them off. In fact, they aren't just ingredients for emotion. They're also ingredients even for perception and thinking. For example, when affect is very strong, so when you have a very strong change in your body and you feel that change intensely, you sometimes experience that change as a perception. You'll say, that guy's an asshole, or this is a fabulous painting, or that was an excellent touchdown. Right? So you are treating your feelings as part of the perception as opposed to your reaction to what's going on. So there's every decision, every action, every experience we have, whether it's a thought or a perception or an emotion, is guided by affect. These simple feelings are a basic ingredient that influence and are actually, some people think, are responsible for, you know, economic decisions and almost every economic problem, meltdown that we had in the 20th and 21st century. That being said, there's no obligation for your brain to make an emotion out of these feelings. You can make many other different types of mental states with them.
And part of it, as you point out, we categorize. I mean, it's like, well, this would normally make me feel pleasure. This I'd normally get annoyed about, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. If you think about, the way I like to think about it is this, that your brain, for your whole life, your brain is trapped in a dark, silent box called your skull. All it receives are sensory inputs, flashes of light, changes in air pressure, chemicals that become smell, and so on. and little aches and feelings from your body in a very, very general way. And it has to make sense of what caused these sensations so that it knows how to act. It knows how to keep you alive and well. So it has to guess the causes of these sensations when it only has access to their effects. How does it do that? Well, it does that using past experience. And so what we call simulations as predictions are also what psychologists call concepts. They are knowledge that you have had in the experiences that you've had in the past that in the past have caused a similar set of sensory inputs. And so your brain uses these to categorize or make sense of the sensory inputs, and that allows you to know what to do next. It also allows you to see and hear and smell and feel.
Well, I mean, as we can be wrong about, lots of things, basically. I mean, we are human, after all. I mean, can we have mistakes with emotions, too? I mean, I guess I'm thinking of the example of you're walking through the woods. In fact, you give this example in the book and think you see a snake. I mean, you're going to jump if it's a snake. You're going to jump and then feel a little silly if it turns out to be a stick. So, I mean, we, based on mindset and what our assumptions are, we can make mistakes about emotion, too, then, can't we?
We can make mistakes about emotion. We can also make mistakes about vision. So, for example, last year, or it may have been 2 years ago now, I wrote a piece in the New York Times about the way that prediction influences vision. So if your brain is making a prediction of what it's going to see next, and then it uses the sensory input to correct that prediction or not, this means that it's possible for you to see things that aren't there because your brain is predicting they'll be there. Now, I want to point out that this is how every single person's brain works. This is why we have baseball and football. This is why we have tennis. If we didn't have predicting brains, we would never have any of these games because, frankly, if you have to wait to see a ball before you swing at it, you will miss the ball. Your brain can't react fast enough and your body can't mobilize an action fast enough to be able to do that. So it's predicting where a ball will be in a moment from now, and it creates the swing based on that prediction. Well, it turns out that this can cause problems in everyday life. For example, if you're a police officer and you're in the military and you're in a highly intense situation where in the past there has been firearms, for example, present, then your brain may predict that you see a firearm and you'll prepare to respond to that firearm even if it's not there.
All right. So obviously situations where it can be dangerous to people. When I found myself thinking at this point in the book, though, about the fact that it seems like we sometimes like to get tricked emotionally. And it leads to me thinking about things like roller coasters and horror movies. It seems like we like the feeling of being scared but not needing to be. And then we get a good laugh out of it.
Absolutely. There is a part in the book where I tell this story about when I was in graduate school, you know, that there was this person who was asking me to go for coffee all the time, and I thought, okay, I'll just go for coffee with him. And I wasn't really that into him. I wasn't really that interested, but we went for coffee, and I found myself, you know, I was starting to sweat a little and flush, and I was having a little trouble concentrating, and I thought, wow, I guess I must really like him. And I didn't realize that I did. And so, you know, I kind of agreed to see him again. And I went home and I opened the door and promptly dropped my keys on the floor and ran to the bathroom and, you know, prayed to the porcelain god, so to speak, because, you know, I had the flu. Now, you might say, well, I mistakenly constructed attraction when, in fact, you know, I was just infected with a virus. But in fact, what I would say is that, no, my brain was taking sensations and creating a real feeling of attraction out of those sensations. It's just that there are usually many factors that are affecting your body at the same time, and your brain can construct a representation of what's causing them that is more or less inclusive of all the possible causes, right? So in another circumstance where I didn't have those jittery, flushed feelings, maybe I wouldn't have felt attracted to him at all, and it probably would have saved me several months of grief, really, in the end, I think.
I could totally relate. I remember feeling heartbroken in college and figured out later it was the French fries. Give me flutters. So is there a missing link in the theory of emotions you're putting out here? Is there a lot we still need to know about the brain to be able to confirm all you're putting out here?
Well, let me be really clear with you that most of the ideas that are contained in this book have tremendous amounts of evidence to back them up. You know, in everyday life, when we use the word theory, we sometimes take that to mean a guess or a hypothesis or something that hasn't been proven yet. But in science, a theory means a set of ideas where there's a tremendous amount of evidence to back them up already. So I think there's still a lot more that we need to understand about how the brain works and certainly how the brain makes emotion. But the ideas that I've included in this book, the idea about simulation and prediction, the idea that there are no individual regions of the brain for emotion, the idea that your brain contains intrinsic circuits that are like basic ingredients and so on, all of those ideas have a tremendous amount of science to back them up. And the book is pretty clear when I'm making informed speculation and when I'm just reporting on the evidence as we know it to be today.
It is a fascinating journey through what goes on in our brains and bodies, because obviously emotions affect us from head to toe. The book is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. It is the work of Lisa Feldman Barrett from Northeastern University. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
All right, take care.